You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Monday, December 20th, 2021. My name is Emma Vigeland, in for Sam Steeder, and this is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Paul Elliott Johnson, PhD, author of I the People, The Rhetoric of Conservative Populism in the United States. Meanwhile, Build Back Better is dead, according to President Manchin. The one who is operating as the actual president, seemingly, but don't say that to Kamala Harris. More on that in a bit, but no child tax credit, no climate provisions, no universal pre-K, no Biden agenda, nothing. Nada. The fallout from Manchin's announcement on Fox News, that's where he did it, included many solemn I told you so's from the six members of the squad that voted against the bipartisan infrastructure bill because they knew that their leverage would be gone after Build Back, or gone on Build Back Better. And look who is right again. As Omicron cases surge, data is beginning to indicate that most of the world's vaccines are effective at preventing, for the most part, serious illness and death from the new variant. Only Pfizer and Moderna plus boosters are providing significant protection against infection. And those are the vaccines that the rest of the world doesn't have access to. So waive the patents now.
And facilitate knowledge transfer.
Yeah. IP. Jesus. Killing people left and right. This comes as the booster effect, or effort, I should say, is lagging in the United States. Only 30% of the fully vaccinated have received a booster, and only just over half of the 65 and over population, the most at risk, has gotten the booster. Yesterday in Chile, in good news, leftist lawmaker Gabriel Boric defeated right-wing, far-right-wing candidate José Antonio Kast in the presidential election. Kast was endorsed, or actually I shouldn't say endorsed, but was a big fan of Trump, Bolsonaro, that kind of guy. Boric will be Chile's youngest ever leader and by far its furthest left president since the U.S.-backed 1973 coup. A massive win for the left in South America. And lastly, Super Typhoon Rai has killed at least 375 people and injured at least 500 in the Philippines. The era of extreme weather, as climate change makes its effects known, continues. All this and more on today's program. Welcome to the show, ladies and gentlemen. Sam is out for the rest of the year, live at least. We recorded some live to tape shows that we will be blessing you with in the best of part of the year, which is the end of the year. Some great interviews that we will be showing to you from that during that time. I want to remind everybody that the big live is not too far away. January 16th, we will be in Boston at the Wilbur Theater, along with many esteemed guests. And tickets are still available, I believe. I mean, they're selling. They're selling a lot, and time is running out. If you want to get your loved one, one of your favorite people in your life, one of our favorite people if they're a Majority Report fan, want to get them a ticket, dull date night, definitely check it out.
Yeah, turn to your partner and say this.
And maybe we need a solution to it that risks the imagination of a new kind of possibility.
Ah, a new kind of possibility of seeing us in person, right? Seeing the fact that we are, in fact, flesh and blood, and we will be there, although vaccine and mask mandates are, it's probably going to happen. Yeah. So, I mean,
timed it perfectly with Omicron.
Yeah, I know, right? Well, at least the surge, I mean, maybe we'll hopefully be in better shape. Well, hopefully we'll be in better shape by January 16th.
Exactly.
And then also check out the merch. Last minute Christmas gift. If it's not coming in time, it's fine. Just blame the supply chain. I'm doing that already.
Yeah.
Like, little pro tip. So you can still
You can take a shot and be political at just-in-time production as well.
Right. And you can still... you can still... not Omicron. You can still get your Majority Report merch on the website. Check it out. There's lots of stuff there. Everything's selling like hotcakes. But, you know, I'm trying to... I'm stalling a little bit because talking about Joe Manchin gives me agita. Joe Manchin has killed Build Back Better, it seems. There's like a maybe, what, 5% chance at resurrection? I don't know. I don't know where I'd put it at because Manchin has lied so often and so publicly beforehand. But here he is publicly lying on Fox News on Sunday. This was his plan all along. I'll explain that in a moment. But here's what he had to say about why he just can't get on board for the provisions that he's known about and has been negotiating with for months now in Build Back Better.
Now, Democratic Senator Joe Manchin of West Virginia. Senator, welcome back to Fox News Sunday.
Good to be with you, Brett.
Senator, you're at the center of this negotiation with the president over his social spending and tax bill, the Build Back Better bill that is not coming up in the Senate before the new year, in part largely because of your reservations. Without you, the leadership doesn't have the votes it needs. So today, right now, what's the state of play?
Well, Brett, you know, this is a mammoth piece of legislation, and I had my reservations from the beginning when I heard about it 5.5 months ago, and I've been working diligently every day and every minute of every day. I've been working on this, meeting with whether it be the president, President Biden, whether it be Majority Leader Schumer and his staff, whether it be with Nancy Pelosi, all of my colleagues, I mean, from all different spectrums of the political spectrum, if you will, from the right to the left. I've done everything humanly possible. And, you know, my concerns I had, and I still have these concerns, and where I'm at right now, the inflation that I was concerned about, it's not transitory, it's real, it's harming every West Virginian, it's making it almost difficult for them to continue to go to their jobs, the cost of gasoline, the cost of groceries, the cost of utility bills, all of these things are hitting in every aspect of their life. And you start looking, and then you have the debt that we're carrying at $29 trillion. You have also the geopolitical unrest that we have. You have the COVID variant, and that is wreaking havoc again. People are concerned. I've been with my family. I know everyone's concerned.
Yeah.
So when you have these things coming at you the way they are right now, I've always said this, Brett.
Mercury and retrograde.
If I can't go home and explain it to the people of West Virginia, I can't vote for it. And I cannot vote to continue with this piece of legislation. I just can't. I've tried everything humanly possible. I can't get there.
You know, I did a tarot reading the other day, and I just, it's not coming up roses for Build Back Better. Like, I wish it was funny, but it's actually quite devastating. This was his plan all along. Here is a tweet this morning from Tara Gulshan of HuffPost. Manchin is on West Virginia radio right now, saying he knew from the beginning he wouldn't support Build Back Better, but let Democrats negotiate. That he got to his wit's end, in quotes, after staff, either White House or Senate, did something that angered him enough to just come out and say he was never going to get to yes. Because that's what this is, right? Like, millions and millions of lives are at stake with this bill. The deadline to renew the child tax credit, which is not going to happen now, is the 28th of December for the payments to go out on time on the 15th. And without those payments, that means that 10 million children will go into poverty immediately. West Virginia is one of the poorest countries in the state, by the way. And now without the child tax credit, there are millions and millions of families that say that they're just one emergency away from not having any money whatsoever and losing it all. That's a direct result of Joe Manchin. And the fact of the matter is that he's right. anybody who had an objective perspective on the situation understood that Manchin, unless there was an all-out blitz from the White House, which there wasn't, Jen Psaki and the White House came out with a statement ripping into Joe Manchin after he, according to Politico Playbook, ignored their calls when word got out that he was going on Fox News to nuke Build Back Better. Basically, they found out, tried to call him, scrambling. This is how incompetent they are with this. And he pressed the red button on his iPhone. He ignored the call. And then he went on Fox News, and they had to scramble to put out the statement, basically. But this is what they should have understood is what he wanted all along. That's the reason that decoupling bipartisan infrastructure from Build Back Better was a bad idea from the get-go. But the worst part of it was that, one, allowing BIF to pass before Build Back Better did, which we can get into in a second, and how many people are to blame for that. But let's just talk about how all of us here knew that this was Manchin's objective from the get-go, that he wanted to cut progressives out of the negotiation process for bipartisan infrastructure and basically pass a glorified highway bill and then kill all of the social spending, which he has successfully done as of this day. So, as I mentioned,
I was just going to say, the question is, like, we knew Manchin was going to do this. Like you say, he was referencing the Constitution earlier. So the question is why the Biden administration basically facilitated him to do this, to run this stuff out through COP, have all this leverage. He should have been threatening, like Sam said, executive orders against coal and all sorts of things that Joe Manchin cares about. But now we're going to see, like, Psaki release a statement. Like, I hope it goes further than that, but, like, do they start doing this conflict too late to actually deliver for people? I hope not.
But. Well, that's my fear, is that now that he's already said publicly that he's killed the legislation, things like what Bernie's saying here, I don't know how much weight they hold. Let's turn to Bernie Sanders, who was one of the lawmakers who had to panic and go on cable television to respond to this abrupt Manchin statement killing the entire Biden agenda. He also in that interview mentioned that he does not support the filibuster once again for voting rights. So like the item that Schumer said, we're going to prioritize this at the end of the year and then we'll get back to Build Back Better in the new year. Yeah, that's dead too because of Manchin. So like,
yeah, it's like they're acting like they're mice in a maze, but everybody can see that it's just like a very simple, like a straight line, and they're just deciding to keep going down side doors into BS.
Exactly. But here's Bernie Sanders responding to Joe Manchin and suggesting that essentially, okay, let's vote on Build Back Better now.
Sure that we continue to pay the highest prices in the world for prescription drugs that the rich do not start paying their fair share of taxes. And I would have hoped that we could have had at least 50 Democrats on board who have the guts to stand up for working families and take on the lobbyists and the powerful special interest. We have no Republican support. Not one Republican in the United States Senate or the House, for that matter, is prepared to stand up to the drug companies or the insurance companies or the wealthy. I would hope we would have had 50 Democrats. Mm-hmm. But if that is the case, then I hope that we will bring a strong bill to the floor of the Senate as soon as we can and let Mr. Manchin explain to the people of West Virginia why he doesn't have the guts to stand up to powerful special interests.
Oh, so you want to vote on it no matter what, even if...
Absolutely. Absolutely. The American people have got to understand what is at stake. For decades now, what Congress has been doing, giving tax breaks to the rich, not standing up to the drug companies, so that we end up paying the highest prices in the world for prescription drugs, ignoring climate change. The President of the United States and almost every Democrat is trying, finally, to address these issues.
Did you know this was coming?
Mr. Manchin doesn't want to support us. Well, look, we've been dealing with Mr. Manchin for month after month after month. But if he doesn't have the courage to do the right thing for the working families of West Virginia and America, let him vote no in front of the whole world.
So how do you tell somebody out there watching, wondering, how come you couldn't get Joe Manchin on board?
He's bought.
Yeah, I mean, that, like... There are two. One is just, I have quibbles with how Bernie's doing this, even though, of course, I agree with him. Of course. The calls And I think Bernie was calling for a floor vote on this prior to this situation. I guess if everyone really was as blindsided as they're saying about Manchin taking this publicly, then okay, I understand scrambling to say let's do a floor vote now. But the time to do a floor vote on Build Back Better was before Manchin said all of this publicly. And they knew that this is where he was trending the whole time. We saw him just like ramble incoherently about all the different reasons why he can't pass Build Back Better. Oh, you know, my dog ate my homework. Oh, inflation. Oh, like, it's kind of cold out today. And I don't really know if I want to make the trip to make the vote or to pass the child tax credit. And, like, actually, maybe I'd prefer if we didn't have any climate provisions so it would warm me up.
And also say things that are very true, like, that's too much entitlement and we need to force these people to work.
Yeah. I mean, like maybe honestly he would be fine with certain provisions like universal pre-K because that frees up parents to put themselves back into the workforce. But the child tax credit, the one that elevates the poverty line in this country when he represents one of the poorest states in the country as well, that is beyond the pale for him. So like there's so much blame to go around in this situation, and like I don't want to hear this shit from I shouldn't have sworn. But I don't want to hear this. Like, I see kind of standard Democratic politicians tweeting out things like, you know, let's not demonize the Democrats about this. Like, the Republicans would never get one vote from a Republican on this. Please! That's why we knew that from the beginning, and that's why this went through a reconciliation process. Like, okay, yeah, we've conceded that point. And the majority of the people in this country vote for Democrats, and they're the ones in the majority. So those are the people that we're dealing with. And there are so many people who screwed this up along the way. Primarily, it's Biden, Pelosi, and Schumer. And like, okay, duh. But like, Biden, as I mentioned earlier, should have been pressing Manchin on this for months, and publicly saying things. And as you, like,
wait, what else did we get? We got right in front of cop saying, hey, the squad needs to play ball because you don't want to embarrass Joe before he goes overseas.
Yeah. Right, exactly. And that's what splintered the progressives on this. I mean, blame lies, I do think, with the way that Jayapal actually listened to Pelosi on this and didn't play harder ball. I mean, I understand that maybe she saw her caucus was just going to revolt and she would not be on the right side of history anyway. But the six squad members that stood up and said, no, this is going to kill Build Back Better. We're going to save the Biden agenda are Jamal Bowman, Cori Bush, AOC, Ilhan Omar, Ayanna Pressley, Rashida Tlaib. Everybody else was duped by Nancy Pelosi, master negotiator that she is, who pushed the bipartisan infrastructure bill forward and just said, trust me, Build Back Better will pass. Don't worry. I will whip the votes. Don't worry. I've got the conservative Democrats under control here in the House. Cool. That doesn't matter because Manchin's in the Senate, and that's where the buck was always going to stop in these negotiations. I don't care that Pelosi can get her entire caucus on Build Back Better in the House. If there is Manchin in the Senate who's going to blow it up entirely, then no deal. They should have never passed bipartisan infrastructure without Build Back Better having going together. So the fact that Pelosi was able to arrogantly think that she could that her caucus would be enough to carry the day. The problem was always with the zero vote threshold that the Democrats had in the Senate. That's where it always was. So I don't know even what we're talking about here, which brings me to Schumer, who had this signed letter from Manchin in his pocket for months and months and months, basically saying, I'm not going to go over this dollar figure. And now that they've gotten essentially down to that dollar figure, what does Manchin do? He blows it up. There's a consistent desire to not reckon with who they're dealing with here. The political corruption involved with Manchin and just like the role that he plays for capitalists and for industry. This isn't office politics. This matters to millions of people. So wake up.
And that's why like David Axelrod saying, yeah, we still had a momentous battle with the ACA. No, you had a battle with people being bought. And that's why the ACA was as limited and didn't lead to the Democrats. Like if we had public option, I'm sorry, like Trump wouldn't have won, right? We could bring that back. And the reason is because the Democrats can't confront to the degree to which they are bought. And okay, you're less so-called bought than the Republicans. Well done. Like that still doesn't, that's still killing people. That's still leaving people out in the cold. That's still, you know, causing even like the child tax credits to expire. Like it's a colossal failure. And you're right to point out the Jayapal thing. We need to reckon with that. And I don't know, when Manchin said he should I become independent? If I was president, yes, absolutely. Get the fuck out of my party. Or the squad needs to seriously look at things like, we're not sharing our fundraising to small dollar donations mm-hmm. with this party anymore.
I think so too. I mean, again, I don't understand. They don't play hardball, and it also just literally takes them to be like hanging off a cliff by one pinky for them to consider, like, I don't know, doing anything about it to save themselves. God, it's so infuriating. We are going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we are going to be joined by Paul Elliott Johnson, PhD, author of I, the People, the Rhetoric of Conservative Populism in the United States. And we have an advertisement for you as well.
So, folks, one of our sponsors today is GiveWell. What is GiveWell? Well, this time of year in particular, people are looking for charities. It's hard to know a charity that you can trust. And maybe you want one that you think is going to be most effective. GiveWell.org is the place to basically find some of the most data-driven, effective charities there is, dollar for dollar. What happens is GiveWell spends over 20,000 hours each year researching charitable organizations, and they only recommend a few of the highest impact evidence-based charities they've found. Over 50,000 donors have used GiveWell to donate more than $750 million that will save tens of thousands of lives and improve the lives of millions more. The best part, GiveWell, totally free. They publish all of their research and recommendations on their site for free. There is no sign-up required, none of it. They allocate your tax-deductible donation to the charity you choose without taking a cut. We did a thing with Sunset Lake where we raised over $20,000 for GiveDirectly.org. GiveDirectly.org is a charity that gives the money directly to people, and because there's a lot of evidence that people living in extreme poverty, you give them money, they know best how to deploy it. I found that charity on GiveWell.org a couple of years ago when GiveWell.org was one of our sponsors back then. And it's great. It's just great to know that somebody else has done the research of this stuff and that you're giving it to a charity that's going to have real effect. And you can read it all right there. They have a list, I think, of top 10 charities, and you can also, you know, look at other charities, but they recommend these, just because they are so effective. If you've never donated to GiveWell's recommended charities before, you can have your donation matched up to $250.
Wow.
Before the end of the year, as long as matching funds last. So your $250 will be worth $500 to a charity that you choose from that list. To claim your match, go to givewell.org and pick podcast and enter the Majority Report with Sam Cedar at checkout. And then bingo bango, you make sure that they know that you heard about GiveWell from the Majority Report to get your donation matched. Check it out. We will put a link in our podcast and YouTube description.
We are back, and we are joined by Paul Elliott Johnson, PhD, author of I, the People, the Rhetoric of Conservative Populism in the United States. Paul, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you so much for having me.
So your book is like fascinating and really made me think a lot, which I think, it's one of these kind of, I said this on the show before, sometimes I have relatives who don't fully grapple with the reality of the Republican Party, and I want to get them your book as like my passive aggressive way to say I've been right all along. But we can talk about that another time. You begin in your introduction, your book, looking at the conservative activists' like contract from that they wrote in 2010 based on the 1994 one. Penned by Newt Gingrich. Why did you choose to start there, and why did you find that was instructive for the rest of your book?
Yeah, so you know, the Newt Gingrich era contract with America from 1994 is part of this you know, kind of Republican what's talked about as a kind of, you know, Republican revolution of sorts, and that's been a touchstone in works on the right. And then of course you have the Tea Party in 2009 and 2010, and they follow that pattern with their contract from. And I was drawn to it because for two reasons. One was, you know, I remember during the sort of you know, aftermath of the Tea Party, there was this quote from Obama about how, you know, the Republican Party just has this fever and we're just waiting for the fever to break. And, you know, to an even greater extent than when I first started writing the project, you know, it's become evident that this was not a fever that was just going to go away, and that there was not just some virus working its way through the U.S. system that would eventually be cleared. So I was drawn to that moment because it was this moment in which people saw something that that was happening that they thought was episodic. And in fact, it seems very much defining. And then just that you know, I study rhetoric and how people talk, and just the prepositional difference between with, you know, and from. You know, with is something that you do with people. The contract with America, you know, they're Gingrich and the Republican Party are saying, like, we're kind of joined with, you know, the population, but there's this implied difference, right, in some senses. And that difference is fading by the time we get to the Tea Party, that it's now the sort of the people, right, who the Republican Party are thought to represent, or whom they argue they represent, are starting to dictate terms. So even it's a very sort of small, right, difference in language. It does, I think, work as a kind of anecdote for where we've been and where we're going, you know, where we are now, and that it's sort of saying, this is how things are going to be, you know, that the people and the Republican Party are one and the same in the eyes of the, you know, the party and the movement. And that's how they're acting. You know, that's how they're framing reality.
Yeah. I mean, well, thank God that fever broke, by the way. I mean, so like when you mentioned the people, I never thought of it this way, but the way that the Republican Party defines the people, the way conservatives imagine it, is very distinct and not, you know, necessarily what is, like, in democratic societies colloquially referred to as the people. How do conservatives in the United States define the people?
It's I think one of the central questions, right? Because they are interested not so much in defining the people through a series of static characteristics, you know, that you might assign to them. Right. I mean, I think they do align them with, you know, whiteness. They align them with the ability to make their own decisions. They align them, in other words, with a set of kind of characteristics that are kind of malleable, right? We know the history of this country. We know that white is not necessarily any static set of identity characteristics. It's more like a position of power. We know that all individuals, right, if they are free to choose, make different kinds of decisions. So that saying that, you know, the people are, you know, this unity of folks who get to sort of decide on things, that's not actually, there's not content to that, right? That's just a statement of about how people can operate in the world. So, you know, the way they define the people is actually more about saying that they have a monopoly over who the people are, and that they get to sort of set the stage for who is and is not in that conversation, right? And so to that extent, then they define the people by kind of saying, you know, here are some of the exclusive characteristics of our people, which is that they are economically viable, right? And that they are producers of things, right? The sort of Mitt Romney makers and takers, 47% vibe is a part of this definition. And they also, right, define them as the people who sort of have exclusive possession or ownership over the nation, right? Which again, the nation itself, right, is a malleable construct over time, right? What America is has changed. And, you know, some people say that's our greatest strength. And I think for many conservatives and the GOP, right, it's our greatest weakness, right? They want to be able to say, actually, there is this idea of what the United States is, what the nation is. It does not change over time. It is actually a kind of static formation in some senses. And it is this ability to have control I suppose you might say sort of dominate the national imaginary to prevent these other kinds of ideas of the people from even, you know, getting to make a case for themselves, which to a great degree, you know, I think is what part of what terrifies the right is that in the 1950s and the 1960s, you saw examples of a people that could be otherwise, you know, thought along the lines of civil rights and the feminist movement. And, you know, their response to that is to say, we have this people that's kind of frozen in time and we just want to keep other people right out of it. Right. You know, we want to monopolize it.
Yeah. You writing about how the opposite of the people as conservatives define it, you know, being, yes, black people, but I think distinct from just that line of thought is it's anti-blackness that is so central to the conservative movement, negating blackness as a way to define one's personhood, which is just so well said in what you write. Tell us a little bit more about that concept.
Yeah, I mean, so, you know, there's this idea, right, in the Black radical tradition, right, a powerful, trajectory of thought that's, you know, created by Black activists, right, civil rights activists, abolitionists, and, you know, scholars, organizers, right, not just in the United States, but around the world. And they're trying to kind of wrestle with finding a language for how to think about the way that racism persists over time, right? Certainly in the United States, and then also the kind of the global elements to racism as well. And one kind of meddlesome question, right, for people working in this tradition, right, whether you want to talk about a Du Bois, the recently passed bell hooks, they're thinking about this problem, which is that, you know, as you sort of alluded to, just talking about Black people, right, creates a kind of confounding variable, right? Because if Blackness is equivalent with all Black people, then you're going to like miss these differences, right, in identity, in position, in attitude that you would find amongst people who would be, right, understood to be Black if we use traditional markers of, you know, phenotype, right, chromatic scheme. So these thinkers and theorists who are sort of pushing and activists who are pushing this question forward are sort of saying, well, you know, what if we think about Blackness not as, you know, just Black people, right? You know, there's a way, of course, to think about Blackness as the Black experience and think about the writings of people like James Baldwin, Fannie Lou Hamer, right? And her speeches, and to say, well, this is an example of Blackness as lived experience. That's an incredibly useful lens for thinking about the relationship between the United States and people who, right, self-identify as Black or identified by the US as Black and how they're treated and how they identify and live. But it's a frame that's insufficient in some ways when we start to think about how the racism of US society, right, kind of spirals or cascades out and has these other effects. So, you know, other sort of scholars who are working in this vein, kind of push forward and they want to say, well, what if Blackness was also this kind of name for when things are designated as, right, dangerous, pathological, and negative, right, by the United States, by its government, by actors in its civil society, by racists, by the right, and then say, right, Blackness is also a name for, threats that are constructed of the United States and its unity and the nation. So this, as a way of reading, right, for what the American right has done for several decades, is a useful strategy because it helps you to see the ways in which, right, racialization occurs and travels on various kinds of policy issues. You know, to give an example that's just sort of in the news today, right, we might think about the way that the welfare state and, social programs, as a result of their articulation in the 50s and the 60s, the right seizes on those and starts to talk about them as infantilizing the American population by associating them with the rise of civil rights, and saying, actually, these are programs that hold people back, keep them from realizing their full humanity. You know, a big part of the critique of the welfare state is sort of saying that, you know, if you're a recipient of welfare, then this makes you a kind of, right, not a real person, right, not a real American. And And that's in part because those programs have been overly associated with or, reduced to things that are for Black folks. So, of course, just to note here, there's a third way of thinking about Blackness that, you know, poets and activists talk about, and that's Blackness is kind of that which can't be understood or managed entirely, you know, by imperialism or by forces of racism. And, you know, part of what the people working in this vein are sort of suggesting is actually, it's very important to note that while the United States can do a lot of awful racist stuff, you know, none of that is guaranteed to work by some kind of God-given force or metaphysical potential, to use an insufferable word. And that's the other thing about Blackness that's important is when people are thinking about resistance and social movements is that, you know, when white sovereignty fails to achieve its aims or when the right, you know, doesn't succeed entirely in shaping the world in their image, you know, that could be understood as a sign of the, you know, capacities of something like resistance to that formation. And that goes by the name of, I think, you know, Blackness.
Yeah. How does an anti-colonial how does like the United States's colonial efforts fit into that specifically too, because I want to historicize like a lot of your book and go back because each of your chapters deals with like a different moment in this new conservative movement starting in the 1950s that also coincides with the Red Scare, post-World War II, I guess, reckoning with how the United States was going to assert itself on the global stage, which has resulted in like a precipitous decline, I would say, and then also a rise in imperial warfare by the United States. Like, how does anti-Blackness translate itself internationally in the way that conservatives maybe moved from a more isolationist perspective to a openly international racist perspective?
That's an amazing question, because I think that one cannot underestimate the role of the Cold War and the post-war context in all of this. And for at least two reasons, right? One is, you know, what was it that caused the United States, to the extent that we would describe it in the late 50s and the 1960s, as a country that was taking egalitarian steps on questions of racial equity and justice? It bears mentioning that to a great degree, and I think both Mary Dudziak and Tom Bolsterman have made this argument and substantiated it quite effectively. It was the pressure of competition with the Soviet Union, right, that pushed the United States to, right, begrudgingly adopt various, right, measures regarding civil rights and public accommodation. And that moment of pressure was accompanied not just by this geopolitical need to win the Cold War with the Soviet Union, but it was also accompanied by a kind of rather exceptional period economically in the history of the country. From 1947 to 1973, the United States has been relatively unscathed by the Second World War. It has massive extra industrial capacity. It has a huge workforce returning from both theaters of war. And it has a government that is emerging in a commitment to fight this struggle against the Soviet Union with massive maintenance of defense spending, with the promulgation of infrastructure to facilitate a kind of Keynesian cycle of consumption, production, and payouts to workers. And so as a result, you have a society that's kind of working at all sorts of different levels, coordinated by government, by big labor, by big business, you know, to create a middle class as a kind of way of saying to the world, the American way is the best way. And as a consequence, there are these, you know, certain achievements that are rendered that are happening as a result of commercial gain and political gain, both commercial gain and political action in the U.S. From this period of time. But the way that's narrated retroactively and by many at the time, of course, is that, you know, America is an exceptional nation. Once again, as an exceptional nation, we have, you know, moved forward to adopt, various proposals and programs on civil rights because we're a really good country. when in fact, you know, Soviet propaganda was working, that there was an American apartheid in the South, to say nothing of the rest of the country, where the sort of status of that apartheid was less legible to many Americans. And we could basically float all sorts of social programs and, you know, buy off democratic deficits with this immense amount of accumulation that we produced from 47 to 73, right? What Elizabeth Cohen, you know, describes as this consumer's republic. So a lot of what was quote unquote, you know, progress within that mid-century period was really coming because of these pressures of geopolitics, plus an immense amount of economic productivity that was unsustainable, you know, because those conditions of that post-war period would not necessarily be reproduced. And as a consequence, the, you know, the idea of what it meant to be an American that's being made in this period of time is highly commercial, and is thinking about exporting that commercialism, that consumptive capacity abroad as well, you know, as well as domestically. So to think about what the right is reacting to, you know, by the 50s and the 60s is this kind of, you know, very complicated United States that's mixing aggressively in an imperial way with the rest of the world, but is also responding to these international pressures by changing things in reaction to the geopolitical situation.
Yeah, so let's actually, I guess, start with the, I mean, maybe we can start with your first chapter on the 1964 presidential election, or I believe that was the first chapter. Am I correct there? Goldwater and his candidacy, plus Reagan's A Time for Choosing speech, in which the... Did we lose you, Paul?
Oh, I'm back. Sorry.
Okay, no, all good. So the Goldwater's candidacy, Reagan's kind of emergence a little bit more onto the political scene, not just Mr. Actor, where he gives his Time for Choosing speech, which I think, you know, gives a real window into how the new conservative movement in this country, how the Republican Party was going to position itself for the next decades to the present, as an embracing of libertarian economic ideology and traditional values, basically. So how did that begin during that time period?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question, because I think, you know, that speech is widely regarded, right, whether or not you ask sort of liberal historians of the right or people on the right themselves, as, you know, one of those really important foundational moments for, you know, creating the new conservatism. And indeed, right, during, you know, the speech was given nominally in support of Barry Goldwater's candidacy for president.
Right.
But of course, Goldwater's people were really worried about it, because they'd seen some of Reagan's speeches and they thought, I mean, this guy might outshine us, and that sort of happened.
He was doing Obama at the 2004 Democratic National Convention kind of situation.
Yeah, I think that's a great analogy. You know, so Reagan is giving this speech, and, you know, he's an avid reader of what we would now call, right, neoliberal economic theory. You know, folks like Friedrich Hayek and Mies van Mises, and these are people who are working in the context of the Second World War and its aftermath. And they have a genuine, right, fear. They have two genuine fears and anxieties, right? One is that actually, you know, from the First World War through the Great Depression to the Second World War, that sequence of events have actually, to some extent, in their minds and the minds of many of the world, delegitimated Western capitalism. And so they are deeply, right, concerned with, right, re-engineering legitimacy for that order. They are also, in some senses, fearful of the strong state, right? Authoritarian and totalitarian governments that, you know, from Stalinist Russia to, you know, Hitler's Germany. These are very much on their mind too. And Reagan is an avid reader of these people's work and, you know, to a great degree believes in both the need for a minimal state, and that the less that the state is allowed to operate and work, the more opportunity there is for commerce and virtue to kind of work. And so when he gives this speech, he's got to kind of shoot this gap in the emerging conservative movement And talking about the state is very handy to him, because I think you alluded to this earlier, right? You have libertarian conservatives who kind of favor the small state and personal liberty. And of course, those commitments from them, right, do kind of allow for the possibility of a significant amount of change in society, because if a lot of individuals decide to kind of go their own way, then you might have a significant reorganization of society. And then you have the traditionalists, right? Often though not exclusively Catholic, believers in the idea of the family, of institutions, and they are hostile and suspicious of change. And they would like for there to be a sort of long running, perhaps, right, spiritually backed laws of society that should be allowed to affect their power on the world so that the mortal order might remain intact. So Reagan, you know, in giving his speech, understands that these two groups might very well be at odds with one another, because if you have a moral order, that restrains the ability of individuals to do what they want to do. And if you have individuals doing whatever they want to do, maybe they will destroy longstanding orders. And so Reagan's solution to this is to kind of lean into this idea of the state. If you go back and you read this speech, there are all these references to camps, enslavement, gulags, totalitarianism. And this is his description, you know, not just of the Soviet Union, right? But more importantly, his description of the effects of the welfare state, right? The taxation regime in the United States, which are, to be clear, right, anodyne elements of modern liberal democracies, right? You produce something, your workers produce something, some portion of it is taken away by the state to fund infrastructure. The idea that, you know, we all live in a society, and so as a result, we have to make sacrifices to one another, and that sometimes those sacrifices will need to be coordinated with the state apparatus that produces certain incentives and certain disincentives. These are equated in much of what he talks about with the hard hand of the state and the threat of, you know, enslavement. And so for a long time, you know, you get these stories about the conservative movement that say, well, you know, Reagan kind of helped facilitate this uneasy alliance between the quote unquote traditionalists and the libertarians. But this is a little bit where I think, anti-blackness kind of comes back into the picture.
I was about to say, you mentioned, I'm writing it down right now, you mentioned enslavement to the state. Okay, you're deliberately conflating like the very rote, or not rote, I should say, benign, conditions of living in a society with the enslavement and torture and murder of a huge amount of black people.
Yeah. And I mean, you know, it's now increasingly evident, right, as we sort of look on the reaction that our society is, that the right wing is sort of enacting in response to anodyne COVID restrictions, right? Mm. Not even always imposed by the government, but sometimes just imposed by businesses that don't want their other customers to get sick or whatever. And these are kind of addressed as, you know, examples of slavery. That it wasn't, it's not a new condition for American conservatism to kind of gesture at the history of American chattel slavery and say, oh, this is an analogy for how we're feeling or for what we're dealing with. It goes right back to the beginning, right, to when the new right is being formulated, where Reagan can say, oh, you're worried that tax rates might, you know, increase on small businesses. You know, you're worried that entrepreneurs might not be able to make their own decisions about, who they can and can't sell stuff to. Well, I mean, that we do have experience with that in this country of people not being able to do what they wanted to do. Mm. And that is kind of how he's working in this moment to say, and to say that in the shadow of the Holocaust, of which there's a kind of emerging consciousness by the early 1960s. And of course, in the more well-known, because of government propaganda efforts, right, the threat of the Soviet Union and the gulags, which were much more aggressively messaged around as the sort of emblem of totalitarianism in the post-war period early on, than even what the United States was fighting against in the Second World War. So that gets kind of, well, not kind of, it is racialized, right, by Reagan in a way, as if to sort of say, you know, this is, this is how the average American, quote unquote, could become the victim of the same kind of genocidal violence that we're familiar with in this country, if they are subjected to being ordered, regulated, and judged by the state, right? And yeah. And to be clear, right, not just the like state in its most nefarious form, but as you say, right, the state in its anodyne, boring model of just doing liberal governance.
And this is all prior to his actual time as president. So, I mean, the speech lays the framework out for everything that we're talking about in the concept of victimhood, of populism, but for the people that we decide, that is defined by anti-blackness, of minoritarianism, which we can talk about a little bit. But now let's move to his actual campaign versus Mondale in 84, the Reagan Revolution, and how neoliberal white hegemony kind of became so it congealed, and it was more of a solid, it was becoming more of a solid form as Reagan wins and becomes incredibly popular during his time.
Yeah, and I think, you know, I chose to talk about 84 because, you know, there's been a lot more, you know, just a lot already written that's excellent on Nixon and the silent majority and on Reagan's campaign in 80, which is a kind of a very conventional populist campaign when Reagan runs in 80, right? It's like Carter is a failure. Washington is a failure. Carter wanted to be outside of Washington, but now he's of it. So let's kind of bring the American people back in into the frame. And so 84 is very interesting because, you know, while people talk about it as this historical triumph, right, Reagan takes 49 of the 50 states and just, you know, absolutely pummels Mondale, for that reason, it's not discussed quite as much. And that it seems like something of a fait accompli in retrospect. But doing work at the Reagan archives and looking at the situation from their campaign side, they actually understood that the economic recovery in 84 was very fragile. And that there was this kind of bubbling possibility that, you know, labor unions and Black Americans and, you know, unmarried women, you know, all kind of might congeal into an anti-Reagan coalition that would, you know, pose a real threat, you know, to Reagan's election if the economic recovery stumbled. And so as a result, they, you know, are thinking about how to best message about this. And they do something which is kind of considered unconventional in populist terms, right? When we talk about populism, we tend to assume strong, charismatic leader, you know, Bolsonaro, you know, Trump, even right to some degree that there are these running debates about Bernie Sanders and whether or not he's, you know, too tough or too mean or something. That comes back to this idea that populism is yeah.
Well, I mean, it's such a ridiculous association, I guess. I mean, but like, and I just wanted to make clear as well, like, this is defining populism as in contrast to labor unions, which seems like, if you are taking these definitions at face value, inherently contradictory. But of course, what Reagan creates is actually a very symbiotic, even though it's like bastardizing these terms.
It's exactly right. And this is one of the, you know, this is one of the problems with how populism is sometimes defined, right? In an overly simplistic sense, is that it's just like any leader talking tough is a populist. And it's like, well, I mean, we got to be a little careful about that. So, but, you know, realizing that things are a bit fragile, you know, Reagan's team actually hires a bunch of slick Madison Avenue campaign guys, you know, called the Tuesday team, one of whom is this guy who is basically a composite of the person that they based Mad Men's Don Draper off of, to come in and invent America. And one way that they're inventing it is, if earlier in the time for choosing, right, Reagan sort of wants to talk about the humanity of the American population as positioned against the unfeeling state and its managerial apparatus in the kind of like Cold War context. By 84, they've so fully leaned into a kind of neoliberal logic that they're now just openly, basically humanizing capitalism by intentionally conflating human commercial activity and economic statistics into one kind of, I guess you'd call it a commodity, right? Or you'd call it a form of life, where they want to say
dream within a dream, a commodity within a commodity, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, it is a very strange, it's a strange formulation, because earlier they made their bones on saying there's this unfeeling bureaucratic system. And, you know, we understand that there's this human American spirit that's opposed to that. But by 84, they're saying, well, here are some images of the suburbs, right? People buying houses, inflation numbers, people buying rugs, you know, GDP numbers, here are some more statistics about, you know, overall employment numbers in the economy. And they're peppering all of this on bucolic imagery of frontiers and valleys and cowboys and astronauts and people getting married. And when they praise, for example, in the very famous, you know, ad that's colloquially called Morning in America, you know, when they praise the sort of move towards lower inflation numbers and more home buying, that's all done alongside a montage of a wedding, you know, and a kind of like white family and Anytown USA smiling, you know, and celebrating. And it sort of lays bare and makes rather evident what critics of sort of the Reagan turn of the right had said for a long time about this linkage between commercial activity and the social construct of the nuclear family, right? That you know, if the 1950s and the 1960s required the production of a family as a kind of economic unit in order to win the Cold War against the Soviet Union, then by 1984, these associations have to be kind of reanimated and kept alive by the Reagan campaign, so that they are saying, no, like explicitly in this advertisement, the reason why these people are getting married is because inflation is lower, right? The reason why this, you know, one man, one wife, two kids, you know, chicken in the pot, car in the garage family, right, exists is because of economic conditions. So it's actually a very brutally instrumentalist understanding of what the family unit is supposed to be, which is it's supposed to be a sign of capital flowing where it should go. And of course, this is also a period of time where you're looking at the immense dispossession of from the home owning class of Black Americans, increasing inequality as unions are being beaten down. And the message from Reagan to their micro-targeted populations, because they're working on these big data sets and they know the voter demographics much better than the Democrats do at this point, you know, is to say your experience of this moment has been good, and so you should vote for us. And they're sort of just writing out all of these other, you know, experiences of America at the time that are not so good, right? That are traumatic and that are catastrophic. And they're just saying, yeah, those people aren't here for mourning in America for whatever reason. Who knows?
Let's naturalize it. And then that's the same why the welfare queen trope used by Reagan was, I mean, as explosive as it was, essentially, was because this person is transgressive. They are taking from the state. It was an amalgamation of everything you're discussing there, and like not a part of this nuclear family structure of like capitalism as showing itself in like the way that society should be organized in terms of race, in terms of like the relationship with the state, in terms of you know, single Black mother, et cetera. Like all of those things are so visible in that trope, which that's why people talk about it so often, but it doesn't make it any less true.
Yeah. And just one more point on that. I mean, the 84 campaign really sets itself apart from Reagan's earlier invocations of the welfare queen. Right. And it's no accident we see them they come up again later, you know, in the next chapter of the book in 94 with Newt Gingrich, you know, because they won 49 out of 50 states. Like they didn't have to kind of break the racist glass in case of emergency, because they had already sort of so populated public discourse with some of these stereotypes that they could then just sort of lean into positive associations between whiteness and consumption, and didn't feel like they had to kind of go, pull some of the kind of harder stuff like you saw in 88 with the Willie Horton ad. And so it is like, that's a reason why this doesn't necessarily get talked about as a populist campaign, because they didn't have to demagogue, right? They didn't have to necessarily give a big angry speech about how America was collapsing. But that doesn't necessarily mean it's not in a certain sense populist. Right. In a way, it's kind of the scariest circumstance because the like white suburbs kind of do this communicative work about who the people are.
Yeah, right. You mentioned the 90s. I want to, before we run out of time, you know, go through every era that you discuss, how the Gingrich era in 94 and the response to the Clinton presidency. How did you see conservatism and their victimhood evolve?
Yeah, I mean, this is the sort of year when the phrase year of the angry white male is kind of circulated in the discourse. And I feel like in some ways we're sort of living in the aftermath of that even 30 years later, you know, whether we talk about Donald Trump and victimhood or, you know, thinking about other kinds of performances of, you know, pained white men like Brett Kavanaugh in public. I think this is a kind of moment that comes directly from that. And for me, the important context for this, you know, midterm election in 94 is, you know, the Cold War ends in, you know, the early 90s. And that induces in America this huge crisis, because if it was the competition with the Soviet Union that caused the United States to move to some degree forward on questions like civil rights and, equality, and it was to some extent also the pressures of that Cold War competition that kept our domestic political situation somewhat restrained. Then the end of the Cold War sort of, you know, pushes the country out on the edge of this cliff all of a sudden. And you've seen this, you know, collapse of unions for several decades. You've seen declining equality. And the consequences of that are America's trying to search for a new idea of what it is and who it is if it's not able to define itself against the Soviet threat. And so it's into that gap, right, that the Gingrich era conservatives kind of march. And they say, well, one answer to this question about who we are is that we actually are having an identity crisis. And that identity crisis is best expressed in the figure of the angry white male, you know, whether or not this is in a movie like Falling Down, or it's in, you know, Gingrich's kind of ludicrous future-oriented talk about progress that's defined against a kind of, you know, the racist figure of the welfare queen and its various associates.
So then let's move into the, I guess, because a lot of this is echoed in the Obama era and the rise of the Tea Party, which, like, you define as there's a much more nihilist element that's growing in the Republican Party's base during this time period. And of course the birther trope, this is kind of a combination of your fourth and fifth chapter here that we'll be discussing, but take us to through that recent history of how conservatives evolved.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's right to describe it as an evolution in the sense that these, you know, embers or nihilistic elements that were sort of always present kind of moved to the forefront. And in particular, it's this idea of injury and victimhood and its, you know, the racial components of it that are so central. Because, you know, you've got a country that's dealing again in 2008 with the collapse, the almost collapse of the global economy and the financial crisis and the industry of high finance. I mean, if we're going to talk about white masculinity, you could make the argument that there's no single industry in the country or in the world, maybe even, this is identified with white guys, you know, straight white guys as finance. And so the crisis, so to speak, is this moment where, you know, maybe there's going to be real exposure or real conversation about who really holds power in this country. But it actually gets, you know, sewn up very quickly by the sort of Tea Party move, where the sense of aggrievement and victimhood that, you know, whether or not it was being stoked very savvily by Reagan or, you know, pushed a little more clumsily by Gingrich, you know, is kind of, you know, for a long time been the driving force on the right. And then it moves into the center of their politics.
And I should also say, I mean, some of this stuff is helped by politicians like our current president, Joe Biden, who was at the forefront of something like the crime bill or the bankruptcy bill. Like, a lot of this becomes so much adopted by the supposedly left-wing party in this country.
No question. And I, you know, even though it's a book about American conservatism, it's not, I hope it's not understood as a tome that in any way lets the Democratic Party off the hook or.
No. You rail against neoliberal politics and then you've got the credibility there. Don't worry. Okay. But anyway, I'm sorry. Keep going. I totally derailed you on the
team
point.
Yeah,
but
I mean,
Sarah Palin as a figure, like the financial collapse, et cetera.
Yeah, I mean, it becomes clear that the Tea Party has this way of talking about what it means to be a real American that is focused on this idea of injury. And, you know, Khadijah White, my colleague at Rutgers, has written an amazing book about this, where she details the way that the media covered the Tea Party and sort of shows how, you know, it wasn't just that they kind of both sided it, but, you know, actually they leaned into the most extreme examples of its racism, right? So people, you know, calling John Lewis the N-word or whatever, and it's very bad, you know. But the scarier thing is actually that the arguments that the Tea Party are making about how Obamacare is slavery, you know, about how tyranny is coming from all these like healthcare czars, you know, about how the Democratic Party is going to quote unquote fundamentally transform, wink, wink, the United States. How actually there's a very kind of a seriously racist core to those arguments, because the central fear is of kind of white enslavement. And that's what Obama's presidency entails. That's what democratic rule entails. That's what a strong state, right, bracket. I mean, it's not like Obamacare is, you know, a huge, like, centralized government violence, but okay, is going to basically turn white Americans, you know, and especially white men into, you know, emasculated, right, you know, blackened people. Like, this is the core of their argument. And the media, by being like, look, focusing on the kind of, I guess you'd say, like, you know, old school racism of occasional participants in these rallies, is ignoring the structural argument about who America is that is perpetuated in the form of these arguments, right? Which is that it's the injuries and the claims and the worries of white people that are the ones that are taken seriously and that amount to, right, a form of racial injury, while the real legitimate historically grounded claims about those, right, people who were enslaved people, you know, who or whose land was taken in the case of the indigenous populations that are here, their arguments don't get that kind of treatment by the media.
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned the word emasculated, or like, you know, associated with blackness as like such a negative definition or branding that conservatives can apply to people. Tucker Carlson cannot stop talking about the feminization of society. And that is, I don't even know how those two get tied together, but it's just essentially, when you are not the people as defined by the conservative movement. Right.
I just want to say that's very well said. I think that's like a perfect encapsulation of where these conservative arguments move. You know, to right. be injured means you're not a man.
And that's why, like, I mean, you see these insane depictions of, in your final chapter on this, Trump, like, bare-chested on a motorcycle waving a tattered American flag, you know, like that. I used to go to Trump rallies and see that stuff all the time. And the idea that he's like the most masculine and he's the most he encapsulates everything that these conservative tropes were trending towards, which is like he's hyper masculine in that he's like incredibly aggressive and unapologetic. He's incredibly white. He presents himself as the wealthiest and most successful. So he's successful in the capitalist structure. And of course he is an aggressive sexist. And so you cannot be Trump is not feminized or whatever. Talk about him as kind of maybe the whitehead of all of the conditions that you described.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the, you know, I mean, some of this is, you know, I was listening to your interview the other day with Ed Miller, you know, and his work on the John Birch Society and how right, we're at yeah. is the logical conclusion of so much that was going on before. And, you know, it is the chickens have really come home to roost, you know, in the sense that the conservative argument about, you might say basically like their argument for the last several decades has really been that there's something like a real America that the actually existing liberal right political system can't incorporate or comprehend this real America in any kind of way. And Trump emerges as a kind of ridiculous character who has outsized capacities, right? Or outsized embodiment of all of the things that conservatives have been accused of being, as you sort of say, for quite a long time. And I think it was the fact that he doesn't care about the logic of it. He is wealthy and famous and, right, treats other people like objects is sexist. And you know, you can point out that there are these contradictions. For example, when he talks about how, right, he is a victim and his supporters are victims. And of course, if you look at the demographics, you know, like Trump does very well with wealthy white people who are not people that are at existential risk in this country. But instead of sort of stopping to worry about what that contradiction might mean for the logic of his arguments, he kind of barrels forward, right? Pushing on this kind of, I don't know, you might call it the like emotional charge or something like that, from like both triggering the libs by causing them to sort of say like, but you don't understand what you're doing. You shouldn't be able to do it. It's not right to be able to do that. While at the same time, more explicitly sort of lording this power over other people and cloaking it in this, I guess, these robes of victimhood and injury, you know, sort of saying like, being, you know, if my existence is trauma to you, like, too bad.
Well, actually relish in it. I mean, the support, that's something I would love if you could just expand on, and then I'll let you go. The way that this provides such a cathartic release for his supporters, even though this very narrative for most of his supporters' lifetimes has been readily available and easily tapped into if one wants like an emotional release about how, oh, woe is me, a white person in America.
Yeah. I mean, it's just, I think this is one of the most troubling things about Trump is that, you know, there have always been these sort of pessimistic or cynical theories about what it means to be a person and to what degree is being a person in the United States defined as having the ability to hurt or injure other people. And the Trump, you know, election takeover of the Republican Party, you know, seems to be suggesting that, you know, this need to dominate and to be in control is the urge, more or less. You can even see it in the January 6th, right, the invasion of the Capitol last year. You know, a lot of people have talked about the aftermath of that and said, oh, well, they didn't have a plan. Like, there were some people with zip ties, but, you know, they were just kind of mostly there and they like messed up some stuff and the crowd kind of like, they just lost it for a little bit. And it's like, well, I mean, if we find ourselves in a situation where like repeatedly and regularly, some people just kind of lose it and do some violence, and then that's, and they understand themselves to be forging a new America out of that process, then, you know, we've found ourselves in a situation where the, you know, the kind of things about Trump that people just thought were jokes or ironic or one-offs are actually more like the core of our, you know, the core of the Republican Party and where it's going. And so these, you know, charges of doing violence to other people, whether or not it's people watching Trump relish and, you know, calling other countries, you know, shithole countries, or, you know, or alternately, you know, actually beating up people at his rallies. I mean, those are extensions of that charge, that thrill. And it's, you know, it's a little at odds with the kind of thrill that people got from, you know, thinking about their sublime life in the suburbs under Reagan. But it's actually kind of part of the same stuff.
Definitely. Well, I really appreciate your time today, Paul Elliott Johnson, author of I, the People, the Rhetoric of Conservative Populism in the United States. Fascinating stuff. Thank you so much for your time today, Paul. Really appreciate it.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it. It was great.
Yeah, it was great. All right. Wait, we already let him go. And we don't need to take a quick break because we're going to have to head right into the fun half. But not after Matt says what's happening on Left Reckoning this week.
Well, Left Reckoning is unclear what's going to happen this week. On this weekend, we released for patrons a reading series. David Griscom and I discussing Vladimir Lenin's Letter to the American Workers. Also, the Green Corn Rebellion show, Greg from Oklahoma, I appeared on that for a nice long interview. If you want to look that up on YouTube, the Green Corn Rebellion show, I also retweeted to find Greg from Oklahoma on Twitter. But those are the two Matt Media News for today.
Very nice. Check out the Nomi Key show. Not sure what's going on over there, but I'm sure she'll have some great guests this week. We will likely be seeing her tomorrow, I believe. But for now, you're just stuck with Matt and I. That's it for the fun half. But we're going to be taking your calls, reading your IMs. 646-257-3920. Call in there, but also just coffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY for 10% off your order. I'm still getting the hang of that one. I probably should write it down, but that would require foresight on my part. Again, 646-257-3920. See you then.
You are in for it.
All right, folks, 646-257-3920. See you in the fun.
Oh, no. Are you ready?
Oh, yeah. Who sent us this?
Anarchy. Alpha males are back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back.
Just as delicious as you could imagine.
The alpha males are back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back.
Just wanna degrade the white man.
Alpha males are back.
I take all of it to my throat.
Alpha males are back.
Snowflake says what?
The alpha males are back.
You are a madman.
And the alpha males are back.
Oh no, Sam Cedar, what a fucking nightmare.
You bring back DJ Denner.
Yeah, or a couple of them, just put them in rotation.
DJ Denner.
Well, the problem with those is they're like 45 seconds long, so I don't know if they're enough for the break.
That's fucking nonsense.
See, white people doing drugs, they look worse than normal white people, and all white people look disgusting.
And the alpha males,
psych. Fuck them.
Snowflake says what?
What?
Snowflake says what?
A hell of a lot of bank. Okay. I'm making stupid money. A hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank.
Lives matter.
Have you tried doing an impression on a college campus?
I think that there's no reason why reasonable people across the divide can't all agree with this. Psych.
And the alpha males are back. And the Africans are black African. And the alpha males are black. And the Africans are back.
When you see Donald Trump out there, doesn't a little part of you think that America deserves to be taken over by jihadists? Keep it at 100. Can't knock the hustle. Come on! Fuck them.
Things I do for the bigger game plan.
By the way, it's my birthday!
Happy birthday to me, Jew boy!
I have a thought experiment for you.
And the alpha males are back. Africans are black. Alpha males are black. Africans are back.
Come on.
Come on.
What?
Come on. Someone needs to pay the price for blasphemy around here.
I am a total
pussy.